My name's Forrest. Forrest Gump. Would you like a chocolate?
Oh, thank you.
It's funny what a young man recollects.
You're the same as everybody else. You are no different.
Your boy's different.
Hi, and welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour, and joined by an esteemed panel here on the Forrest Gump issue of the VFX show. So, starting with you, Jason Wingrove, how are you, sir?
I'm extremely well. All the more for doing possibly my favourite film of all time.
Oh, really? Wow. Well, let's just not set the bar too high there. Todd, you're also there, are you? You're in...
Yes, sir.
In California?
Yes, San Francisco, Santa Rafael, actually. California.
As featured in the film. So I'm going to catch up with what you guys are up to later in the film. Right now, I wanted to get started. Well, I was going to ask you whether you liked the film. I assumed that you would have. Jason's already answered that question. So Todd, let me ask you right out of the gate, a film that you enjoyed?
Yeah, Zemeckis in the 80s and 90s, one of my favorite filmmakers, and Forrest Gump is definitely one of those. It's one of those that I have such an interesting relationship with. I can't watch it too many times. I literally don't want to watch it more than like once a year because I want to. It's just so emotionally taxing on me. I love this movie so much.
Well, I will confess to watching it again last night. Obviously, I've watched it many times in the past, and I, you know, I still teared up when Jenny died. Not to give any plot points away, but yes, I think it was when he's standing over her grave. Oh, Jenny, he's so proud. He's so bright. Talking about young Forrest, I'm like, I'm fogging up the glasses. and that's pretty remarkable, really, because this film gets, I think, sometimes historically slightly short-shifted as being an effects fest and built around the effects. But I actually think that at its heart, this film just was a good film. I mean, I really did just think that it was a good film. Jason, I didn't give you much of a chance to comment on it, apart from your initial comment. Where does it sit for you?
Yeah, well, look, I mean, it's probably one of my most loved films. It is sometimes a little bit soppy, I think, but I think that it really does have such emotion. I've never, like, shed a tear or anything or got misty when either of my children were born or on my wedding day or anything, but the very last frame of this film gets me right in the back of the throat every time.
It's, my God, that's a confession.
sad, but true.
It's okay. Well, look, we're going to work our way through the visual effects on the film, but let's discuss a few other aspects about it before we get there. One of the things I wanted to discuss, as you regular listeners of the VFX show will know, we try and pick a topic these days and kind of run it in parallel with the film, especially for these retro films. And I believe the one that I'd like to touch on this time is this concept of kind of visual authenticity and historical accuracy, because this film does go to a lot of trouble to provide very visually authentic imagery from various periods in time, while of course being completely historically inaccurate in the sense that there's a character that that appears much like a character in an early Woody Allen film. Did anyone see that Woody Allen film? Was it Zeitgeist?
You're talking about Zelig, right?
Zelig, that's it. Sorry, yes. So that was that before? I presume that was before this, right?
In my memory. Zelig was 83.
There you go. So, I'm not going to compare it to that, but just in terms of general stuff, let's just start with Zemeckis for a second, because Zemeckis was really hot in this period, wasn't he, Todd? I mean, this was just sort of, he was one of the brightest stars of the kind of, because he was about, what, 43, I reckon, when he made this.
Yeah, I mean, let's see, he'd already gone through the Back to the Future trilogy. He had done Roger Rabbit. He was just on fire. And I guess the only misfire was right before Forrest Gump was Death Becomes Her, which after that amazing body of work, some thought, including myself, that Death Becomes Her was a bit of a step down.
He did write that 1940-something thing for
1941
Spielberg.
1941 for Spielberg.
With Bob Gale. Wasn't a huge hit. One of the greatest Spielberg flops of all time. He actually won the Student Academy Award for A Field of Honor, which is something that Lasseter and Spike Lee also won. So he was pretty hot right out of the gate.
And if you guys haven't seen his the first real feature, Used Cars, with Kurt Russell, if you're like sick R-rated like comedies, it's going to be right up your alley. It's really witty, and I think it still holds up. And Kurt Russell's just typically awesome in it, but yeah, Used Cars is definitely a good Zemeckis early film.
So how much are we putting the glory, because this was both critically and box office success, how much are we putting that glory at the feet of Zemeckis, and how much are we putting it at the feet of Tom Hanks and, let's face it, other really good cast members like Gary Sinise? Do you feel this is like really Tom Hanks' triumph or Zemeckis' triumph?
There's a lot of Hanks in there. Obviously, there's some amazing performances that tie it together, and he really did inhabit the character in my book. I'm not sure who was actually involved in the screenplay, but whoever took the original book and turned it into this screenplay should have got the Oscar, because the original book was quite a lot different to what was filmed. You know, they actually went into space with chimps and stuff, and so it kind of did rein it in a bit.
Well, it was also darker, right? Like the famous line, life is like a box of chocolates. And I think in the book was life isn't like a box of chocolates, or life isn't a box of chocolates. It was actually sort of more cynical than this one. So it really was quite a different film in that respect. Hey,
yeah, I know that the rights to the novel bounced around Hollywood quite a bit, and it was I'm not entirely sure about the genesis of the project, but some thought it was just unfilmable, and it was such a sweeping project, and it had gone through so many iterations that I think it was Eric Roth who finally brought it all together. He wrote the final adaptation. Yeah, it had a tortured history in Hollywood, apparently.
Now, I'm right in saying this is not the Eric Roth of the VES. This is the Eric Roth, the writer, who actually penned a whole lot of really good films, right? It's a different Eric Roth than the one that most people would know of from...
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes, not the acting Eric Roth.
Or and who the also caught head of the VES.
Yeah, exactly. And who also caught a lot of heat for writing the screenplay for The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, has some eerie similarities, convenient similarities to Forrest Gump.
Well, leaving that annoying subject of writing to one side, this is Ken Rawson and ILM, and I remember when it came out really distinctly. This was the film that you would point to as a reason to buy a flame or an inferno. Of course, ILM called their infernos sabers, but... this was just the classic case of not real time, but very interactive compositing just being a stunning success. So do you remember when it came out?
The film was 1994. So for ILM, that was like the first, I think it was the first big film after Jurassic Park for them.
And do you remember it, as I do, as being a really big kind of beacon for pointing to things and saying, look what we can do now with compositing? Because I remember it just was sort of like, wow, we can do anything. But it was very much a compositing rather than a CGI film after Jurassic.
Yeah, I think if Jurassic was the here's the first chapter of computer-generated character animation, I think Forrest Gump really heralded the next chapter of compositing and what you can do with it, particularly for a film that, you know, it is not necessarily about spectacle. It's about having the world blend in and not, you know, for the most part, a lot of shots you're not even meant to notice. Mm. So it really harnessing the power of compositing to tell this story that can't be told without visual effects.
Jason, do you remember, where were you in sort of filmmaking terms when you saw this?
Gosh, 94, probably just starting to, maybe not even quite starting to direct. I was probably quite frustrated with what I was doing in the camera department and wanting to bust out and do more and being incredibly, inspired by Zemeckis' ability to use effects, which has always been, you know, a sort of love of mine, use it for the benefit of the story and not use an effects just because we can, but every single sort of little tiny little element of effect throughout here is always at the benefit of the story, or just to have a little extra touch of emotion, or to tie little threads, tie all the eras and decades of this film together, like the birds and the birds in the tree and the feather, of course, to I think that's where I really got my love of Zemeckis, is probably from this film more than even the Back to the Futures. I just love his use of effects to add something rather than just because we can.
Because Who Framed Roger Rabbit was essentially an optical composite, wasn't it, Todd? This wasn't
that's right.
a big Inferno-y kind of compositing job, whereas this really was Inferno and Flame coming to the forefront. I'm going to ask you guys in a second to name your favorite shots and why, and I'm going to give you a moment to think about that while I just tell everyone mine, just so I don't sort of ambush you. And the one that I really got to like that wasn't obviously the one that I first noticed, because it almost is something that passes without noticing. There's a scene when young Forrest, Jenny and Forrest are walking back to the house of his mother late in the film, I mean really late in the film, and yeah. in this shot... Yep,
you took mine.
Okay.
No, you took one of my two.
And in
Come
this
on,
shot,
go ahead.
Well, no, in this shot, I'm sure I didn't notice it the first time I saw it. I may not have even noticed it the second time I saw it, but I came to just appreciate what a beautiful touch it was. The trees encase the road in a way that sort of primarily shades the road, but not entirely. And the filmmakers actually shot a time-lapse sequence, very subtle time-lapse sequence, of the sun moving such that all those shadows, those mottly shadows, moved across the ground and started to go up the tree trunks as the sun obviously moved from left to right, but not like it's going from day to night, just really subtly, and then recomposited the characters walking away into the same shot. So what you've got is this sense of a lovely passage of time without the use of dissolves or any other kind of obvious tricks, but it was soft, and also it was kind of a sense of a calm that they existed in this world and that they were kind of at peace with it. And I just thought it just works so nicely. And yet in a film that was back-to-back with much more sort of obvious effects, it's the one that's lasted with me.
It's very subtle. Very subtle. And as you say, sometimes you can miss it, and it's affects you emotionally more, just as much as it does visually. And it does work with the shot. You know, it's young Forrest with older Forrest heading back to the house where he kind of grew up. So it's just a lovely little touch that could easily have just not done it. You know, the shot would have worked. It's fine. But it's taken a simple little shot and turned it into something more.
I said I took one of yours. What was the other one?
Just anything to do with the feather, particularly the end feather. I don't know why. It's particularly that last bit when the little note of the Silvestri score finishes up and the feather just goes boom right into the lens, and it's just like, whoa. It's just almost like the collective emotion of the entire film just comes right back to me, and it's just, I can't understand why that, you know, it's not. The feather is always such a motif that it's a bit hard to sort of work out what it means to the film, and it means something to everybody differently. I can't put into words exactly why it's emotional. It just is. And
there is a real sense, isn't there, with this film that they used that time. You know, so obviously there's a period of time. It's a bit of a gift to some filmmakers and a pain to others when you've got some titles going on and you don't have any dialogue normally. You very rarely have any sort of serious exposition, but you can normally set a tone. And there are very few films, I think, we could find that set that tone better than that feather in the opening sequences. It just really seemed to be that idea of, is the world accidental? Is it deliberate? Am I drifting and being affected, or am I being moved?
It's not a film that films rushed or too slow, and I think that's sort of, I think that just all helps tie, you know, the beginning and the end of the film together. And it's just a very interesting, as you say, it's kind of timeless. It's it has a very unrushed quality about it. You have time to play with a face like that.
And,
you know,
it's not necessarily a plot term, point. It almost feels magical. I mean, as if there's something enchanting or enchanted about his life. Todd, what about you for shots that, or effect shots that you really liked?
Well, I have two. One is more spectacle than the other. It's one of the last shots in the Vietnam sequence with Forrest carrying
Bubba.
Oh boy, Bubba out of the jungle. And it's that really wide shot where Forrest and Bubba are really tiny in frame, just at the bottom of the frame, and you know the airstrike is coming in, the napalm strike. And you hear the planes coming, and you know they're coming, but you don't really see them yet. And you see Forrest running, even stumbling out of the jungle as the bombs start getting dropped. And the way the shot flows, that beginning, middle, and end, where the beginning you're like, oh, he's just running out of the jungle and he's just going to make it out, and then the entire jungle basically gets incinerated behind him all in one shot. You know, Zemeckis, the king of the long take, all in one shot. And I think even to Forrest and Bubba running past camera.
The shot does actually go, your attention goes to the explosion. They stop being the center of the shot. I think you either, they either lead the shot or they drop down. But, yeah, I remember noticing that.
Probably does encompass, you know, as you say, this is a real showcase for, as you say, the beginning of the compositing age and the digital compositing, and that shot really has it all. There's so many layers in there.
I mean, you talk about immediacy, and you can clearly see Tom Hanks's face throughout the entire thing. I mean, that's the type of shot that, like, the Ralston Zemeckis collaboration could design, and, you know, and to such great success. The other one actually isn't an optical. It's more of a camera trick. It's early on in the film. I think it's one of the first times we see adult grown-up Forrest. And he's being chased down that same road by the bullies in the car and the truck. And he you're just kind of determined, you know, realizing that he can run really fast. And he is just a few feet behind the truck, and they're running toward camera. Forrest runs camera right, goes out of frame. We pan with the truck that was just behind him, and by the time we finish the pan, we see Forrest way off in the distance. Like between the time he left frame and the time we picked him up again, he hit turbo boost and he was all the way down there.
And yeah, and there's just a flurry of dust, and
the trees are moving. Yeah, it's just a fantastic little camera trick to help tell the story. You may, once again, you may not even notice it, that's what happened, that Tom Hanks actually ran out of frame, and the stunt double with the same costume and everything was actually way, way, way down out there, and the timing had to be just right. I mean, I love that kind of camera trick, and it wasn't an optical; it was all done in camera. But
and if
it's
you'd
that
done
kind
it, if you'd seen, sorry, if you'd seen that speed change on screen, it probably would have looked silly. You know, I guess that's
exactly
give you the idea of it without actually showing.
Well, because it's the VFX show, let's dig into those two shots. Firstly, you said it wasn't an optical, but as I understood it, it absolutely was an optical.
Really?
Yeah, Tom was running in a plate without
the
car.
The beginning.
Yeah, he's running in a plate without the car. He runs out of shot. He's then placed on top of the shot of the truck, and the truck is the hero plate. You'd pan with the truck with a composited Tom Hanks on at the beginning, but obviously exiting frame. Now, when the truck turns round, it isn't Tom Hanks in the distance. It's a stuntman who already started way over there.
Gotcha.
And it's the stuntman that does the running and the leap. That's why it's a stuntman, over the fence. And so what you've got is basically a comp at the beginning of putting Hanks in, and the rest of it is played out in one shot, though, of course, the stuntman had the advantage of already being three quarters of the way across the field before the camera did the pan.
Oh, forgive my inaccuracy, but that, I mean, just even that description, I mean, think about the layers of trickery that are actually going on there. I mean, that's just fantastic.
I'm going to sound really contradictory when I say this, but I found that both terrifically great and annoying. What I found annoying was the preceding shots where he seemed to be right in front of the truck, then well away from the truck, then right in front of the truck, then well away from the truck. That kind of took me out of the film because I was like, well, you just keep resetting the clock on how close that truck is.
Yeah, the fact that then that one close-up of the legs and the bumper, they played up the fact that he was like 6 inches away. They really played up that proximity. And then in the very next take, he's about 20 feet away from the truck. Yeah, I hear you. I totally agree on that.
But I will say that actual individual shot that you're talking about, I do like, because what I liked about it is that Tom Hanks' character is retelling his view of what happened. And so some of those sort of inaccuracies felt like they'd come from the storyteller, if that makes sense. That it was actually, you know, if you recount a story, you don't get it quite right because you're just remembering the story. And I always thought that that's what the film did, that it had little moments in it that weren't quite right. But as a deliberate kind of storyteller, just skipped over that bit kind of, like, for example, the fact that the braces on his legs kind of magically broke apart felt like a recounting of a story and not a tall story, just a recounting of a story. And
yeah,
so I sort of went with
fish.
It. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I felt the same way with a bunch of the shots, that it had a slightly magical quality that didn't make you think the story was fake, but did feel like it was a retelling of a story, which I thought was good. It's
same with your time lapse trees shot, you know.
Exactly.
That's slightly magical about it, but it doesn't take you out of the film, does it?
I think, and frankly, all of the sky replacements, there are a ton of sky replacements in this film to basically show off beautiful blue skies, puffy white cumulus clouds, and almost just picturesque in almost every way, and same deal.
So if we want to just get picky for a second, the other shots we mentioned are the feather shot and the running out from Vietnam. So let's just hit those while we're on them. Yeah. So the feather shot was, I think most people probably know now, is shot on blue screen with a fan underneath to cause them. And I think it was actually, you know, being hand kind of played with.
I think it was Ken himself with the feather on the string with the fan underneath kind of performing it. And I may be wrong, but I think they did have to morph together a couple takes of the feather action in order to marry it into very specific points, especially that opening shot of it landing on the fella's shoulder and then blowing off again. And there are a couple clever little morphy morphs.
And at the end, there's a CG feather that gets it to line up with the actual feather.
With the actual feather.
So you've probably got two or three takes of wire feather, one CG at the end. Actually, interestingly, the only point in that shot that I thought didn't work was when it lands on the guy's shoulder, where it seemed like the fringing was wrong. But when it goes over the car, the reflections in the car are perfect. I mean, they're just exquisitely done.
Yeah, and once you sort of see that it's been actually been removed from his shoe the entire time, that the patching out of that, given some limitations of the day, is actually pretty impressively done too. It's only when you're really well able to study that you sort of can see a little bit something there. But it was, again, nothing that ever took me out of the film at the time or too much sense.
And in those feather shots as well, if I may add, the fact that it kind of happens, you know, obviously when they shot those crane shots with no feather, had to imagine the beats and where it was going. And in a way, the feather is pretty well framed, but it also feels very honest camera work. Like they're doing their best to keep up with it, but not to pan tilt the heck out of the shot to make everybody dizzy. You know, it just feels pretty natural.
I think it's those two kind of elements that you can easily put together in any timing and it will sort of feel natural. I think part of it comes from the fact that they did use a real feather and it is really under the influence of real wind. So I think that, you know, because obviously they can create a CGI feather, but they chose to not use the CGI feather all the way through because there is so many lovely little subtleties in the way it moves that, you've got it for free, why not use it? So I think the fact that it is moving so naturally, you could probably composite that against any kind of random operating, panning around on the sky and get away with it because it's just you're starting with such a
an physically honest correct physics. Yeah,
physics are at play, I think. So,
it's an iconic sequence, and who am I to, for the great Ken Ralston? I mean, and then I'm not being sarcastic, but I would say this. Did anyone feel, looking at it today, that if I was bidding that shot today, I'd have gone for a different depth of field. I would have actually had more play of the feather being in or out of focus with the background being in or out of focus. Because it had quite an infinite depth
and the background dropping out more.
Yeah. Did anyone else feel that, or was it right the way it was?
You would have followed focus a little bit more and played with it. There's something about there's something about this, the grandeur of it all being sharp, and I don't know.
It was high sun.
Tough one.
It is a pretty sharp film, and there's not a lot of shallow depth on it. It's, it's kept quite natural and quite real. It's not overly, I think because the story itself is so slightly fanciful, it's shot slightly more realistically. It kind of lets you get away with some of that fanciful stuff. You know, if it was all shot quite in the fantasy feel or soft focus or shallower depth, then, you might not be able to get away with so much, I think.
Maybe for that darker version of Forrest Gump that was never made.
Evil Forrest.
I'm glad it wasn't, really.
Let's discuss the running out of the napalming sequence. So that was initially two stunt actors, and then there's about a third of the way into that shot. Before I leave that, that feather shot, at the time it came out, and I remember this really distinctly, was, I think, the longest on-screen visual effects compositing shot we'd ever seen on screen. That's, like, to give you some perspective on where we are in terms of visual effects. Seems like a simple comp now, but that was unprecedented in its duration.
And add to that the opticals, right? There was, because the opening credits were over that as well, so you had to take real good care not to kill you know, the print, you know, too many optical passes because it's already having enough with the visual effects, but then the title's over it. You know, that's a nail biter.
So let's go to they're running out. As I was saying, there's two stunt guys at the very beginning. There's a little point where he sort of dips or stumbles.
Yeah,
that's where they swap to Tom Hanks. Now, at that point, Bubba is actually, the actor, is on wires suspended from a crane above. So I assume that the crane only went that far, and that's why before that they had to use a stunt guy and cut into it. So
yeah, I was wondering why there was a transition at all, because a lot of the shot is Tom actually carrying Michael T. Williamson.
And I just don't think that the crane went any further than that, and so to get that first bit of the shot, you had to have somebody carrying somebody, and they had to be beefier than Tom was and lighter than Bubba was, if that makes sense. Of course, there are CG planes dropping the napalm, and there are real explosions, and so there's a lot of roto, and a lot of timing those explosions, or rather back timing the napalm drops to match those explosions. And some really good color grading as well, because I felt like that all came together and all the blacks matched perfectly. I mean, it's a very well-executed technical shot, wouldn't you say, Todd?
I think so. And another thing that, you know, sometimes with these shows, we want to think about how that shot would have been done today. And I think about the camera shake that's going on in that shot. It's actually fairly subtle. The camera is craning or just tilting down, and then when the napalm blasts go off, there's a bit of rotation, but you know, it's subtle enough and that it feels very natural. It gives you the sense of explosiveness. But yeah, it doesn't blur the frame so much that you then lose the beauty of the shot or the actor's faces and things like that. I want, you know, and that's also to benefit, you know, to the compliment of Ken Ralston and everybody, to be relatively restrained with something like that. But, you know, you see camera shake today with an explosive event. You know, somebody, you know, drops a pen nearby and somebody adds a digital camera shake that, you know, is, you know, the whole frame bounces up and down.
Oh, and the pen would ricochet off the table and come straight at your camera.
All these days you just grab, you shake the shit out of the camera and just be over to VFX department to try and fix it up and try and comp 10 layers together over the top of your motion blur.
Exactly. So, you know, stuff like that, I love that restraint. And I don't know, I think the shot really holds up.
But the shots that would have to have been the ones that captured the imagination of the public were Gary Sinise's character's legs being amputated, rather the fact that he was in so many shots where the camera really seemed to linger on his stumps in an almost, you know, FU kind of way. It's like, you know, yeah, you think you're going to pick it? Well, we're just going to linger on this shot while he's held here. You can study it as much as you like because you ain't going to find a fault in this. I mean, that was not ILM showing off, but it was, retrospectively, ILM showing off because those shots were uncompromising. I remember at the time thinking, why would you just linger on them like that? But of course, they held up. I mean,
I'm reading from my notes right now. Are the Lieutenant Dan shots ILM showing off?
I think there was a point at which Ken Ralston felt like the audience needed to have a good look at them, because otherwise it would be like, you didn't show us the legs. You know, you're just tricking us. And I like the bed shot in particular, the way they cut a hole in the bed so his legs were going straight down through the mattress. And so when they pulled him out, his legs were dangling down. They just replaced that big hole or slice out the side, I guess, of the bed. But even saying that, removing the and replacing, because, you know, you put something in blue, it's easy to key, maybe, but certainly it's not providing the background, because there's an actor is moving behind those green stockings. We're going to have to replace whatever we lost, and that isn't a simple comp. That's a very complicated problem.
Repairing the material around the stumps, there's just a ton of work there. I'm not sure the blue really helped them that much, but it's certainly pretty faultless even today. You know, a lot of that repair work is quite amazing. I think the only thing that ever gives it away to me is just the pure physics, the weight of his legs affecting his body, and that's something you just can't
remove, center, you know, of gravity.
It's his C of G, exactly, yep, which you just can't, you know, you just can't fake. You have to I guess, engineer your shots where it doesn't, it's not going to affect him. And that's the kind of thing, until you really don't see it, until you're actually sort of at the very end of the you know, until you've done the shot and you go, yeah, maybe it's affecting him a bit. But, you know, hey, this is the first, really the first time this has kind of been done. So, you know, it's been done a fair bit since, I guess.
One of Ken Rolston's genius moments was, for example, in the shot on New Year's Eve when they're in the sleazy hotel room, which, by the way, I'd really refer people, if you want to hear more, Ken Rolston talks about this in an interview I did with him recently over on FX Guide and the FX podcast. And Ken Rolston is just a heck of a nice guy, but he discusses that whole idea of putting in objects where the legs would have needed to move through so as to help sell the shot. And that's particularly the case with that coffee table, which is kind of like a barrel looking thing. And Gary Sinise spins around on his butt, thus his legs would have had to have been straight out in front of him, and they would intersect the coffee table. Of course, the coffee table wasn't there on the clean pass, and it was comped in later. In many respects, I love that as a visual effect, because it's the kind of simple trickery that I've always felt is the sort of hint of the magician. It's the misdirection. You know, you're misdirected to thinking that can't be there, and you're not looking at the coffee table and saying, is that comped? You're looking at the end of his legs going, where did they take them off?
Well, and think of the hospital bed shot. That does the exact same thing. That it has a beginning, middle, and end. The very first time they pull back the curtain, you see Lieutenant Dan with his bandaged up legs. And it doesn't stop there, because the orderly comes by and picks him up. And it's like, you know, oh, you thought we just kind of hid his legs inside the bed, you know, poke some holes in the bed. Nope, here's the whole thing. You know, here's that the trickery again, the sleight of hand. You thought we had it here. No, it's actually over here. And actually, they did the exact same technique with him on the jumping off the tramping boat.
Yeah,
where he
staging it all by a slot in the door. Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Okay, so that stuff is incredibly impressive. But perhaps the most vivid memory people would have is Forrest being comped into archival footage. And I think this is really interesting, because the effects we've discussed up until this point, the napalming, compositing, the stuff with the legs, take nothing away from all of that. But it's a very different type of visual effects work than the 2D work of making a Ku Klux Klan character ride in a Birth of the Nation piece of footage. And actually involves some really interesting, I'm going to say technical, but they're almost artistic decisions from the visual effects team, because the real craft there was analyzing the original footage. I mean, obviously someone had to pick some great footage to start with, but Jason, it's not an easy job, I don't think, to look at something like that black and white footage of the Ku Klux Klan and be able to pick the lens, the height of the lens, the angle the lens was on, and everything else, to be able to refilm what is actually quite a complex move with I don't know what his character meant to be. It's not Gump, obviously, but it's the ancestor.
No, it's
Gump.
Birth of a Nation footage, isn't it?
Yeah, but whatever the name
is. Which, weirdly, until I re-looked at the film today, after having seen it probably a half a dozen, 50-something times, I didn't, and maybe re-looked and must have missed that chapter in the making of five times and realized, oh my God, right, it's comped into vintage, you know, D.W. Griffith footage. that's the level of sort of subtlety of work here. You know, I just presumed it was, you know, let's get a whole bunch of horses, but then no, it's really iconic footage. I've done that in the past where I've had to match a shot from today from older stock footage, not from that old, but on a crane, and it's very hard. You literally have to. By guess. I mean, that one's even more of a guess, because the footage doesn't even start as a comp. I at least had the luxury of, you know, trying to match it with, you know, in video split with someone with a vision mixer in the old analog days. But incredibly hard to do that kind of thing. But if you look at it, that is a really seamless comp now, and very, very, you know, beautifully done.
And actually, obviously, quite a complicated shot if you were shooting it just normally. Like, you're starting below the height of the guy on the horse, sort of saddle height, I guess, looking up, and you have to pull up to a crane shot looking down on on an entire mob flying through frame dressed I can say neo-Nazi, but it's not really Ku Klux Klan nasties. But the thing is, it's a point in the shot that you pointed out, that it starts 100% live modern and ends up virtually, what, 95% archival. And I didn't pick the transition at all. I thought that was a really good comp.
It's literally, I guess, by the time the camera rises up and pans around to be the road, it is actually that it is matching the same height as the original footage. So literally, it's almost just slipping that footage in and, well, it's that easy. Yeah, sure. It's a matter of you can have that camera move as long as you end up matching the height by the time you pan over. So it's a match. Literally, the footage is slipped in left to right as the camera pans over. But yeah, not easy. And then you've got an actor who's not a professional horse rider pulling up, doing a U-turn on a horse in the middle of the frame and matching the angle and getting the light right. And then, obviously the rest is over.
And the timing so that he didn't look like he was going to be, caught up with by the other horses. So I liked that a lot. I thought it was more successful, for example, than the George Wallace comp. What do you think, Todd?
The George Wallace one, I think, yes, definitely suffered a little bit in that, especially when you compare those two back to back, there's a lot going on in the Birth of a Nation shot. You don't see a lot of faces. The George Wallace shot is one of the first ones where we actually linger on the footage. I did like the fact that they didn't decide, again, great shot design from Ralston and Zemeckis, putting Tom, not just blue screening Tom and putting him into the Wallace footage, but Tom and a stand-in, an extra, and then blue screening them into the shot. So, intellectually, you're kind of looking for the matte lines between Tom Hanks and the guy next to him. Well, you're never going to see that because those two were photographed at the same time.
But they weren't. The interesting. Sorry, just to... they didn't have that guy.
Did I screw up again?
Well, no. It's just funny. Like, it's just trivia that we've found in looking. I would have said exactly the same thing. But in our research, we discovered that they had to shoot the security guy on a different day at the last minute. So it ended up... what you're saying is still true, right? This idea that you're looking for a difference between Tom Hanks and that guy. It just so happens, ridiculously, that guy wasn't available the day they had Tom. And so they ended up having to do a double match. They did match Tom to that guy and that guy to Tom and that both of them back into the footage, which I just thought was funny. But you're right. I mean, like, that. The technical consideration notwithstanding, the fact that guy kind of glances around at Forrest Gump but doesn't kind of totally interact with him, I think helps sell the shot a lot.
Yeah. If he had turned around and shook Forrest's hand, obviously then the illusion would have been, blown a little bit more. I particularly like how they kind of fed it in or mixed in those shots with other shots that were staged by the production that were then treated to look like newsreel of the girl. No, I hope I don't get this one wrong. The girl dropping her book and Forrest going to pick it up and giving it back to her.
Yeah.
That was staged to look like it was old newsreel footage.
Well, of those sort of newsreel historical footage things, I mean, some of them were monumental events, that clearly were incredibly significant. Others were sort of odd bits of footage that they must have found, like especially the presidents, quite often completely the wrong footage, and they lifted those out. I think I'm right. Okay, I'm really going out on a limb here. Does anyone remember if in Contact, there was a film like Contact, there was some film where they found alien life, and they remember they had footage of President Clinton discussing something.
That's right. That is Contact.
Is it?
That's President Clinton discussing, I think it was a Mars project on the lawn, the East Lawn or something. And he was in the script, he's supposed to be giving the speech in the press conference room, in the press room. So he was painstakingly rotoscoped out of that footage and put into the White House press corps. Luckily, I think most of that stuff was displayed on monitors. And I don't think you ever, you did see a couple of shots of like Scott Glenn and Jodie Foster, I think, on the side, on a profile. That's right, a profile.
But that was also a Zemeckis film.
Seemed to think the White House had the poos with that, actually. I think they.
Well, that was another Zemeckis film, but in that shot with the Clinton, they bothered changing his tie. If you ever look at that footage in a making of, they put a new tie on him. And to this day, I'm like, why did you care to change his tie? Like, the president's tie didn't look presidential enough for you? Anyway, okay, so of the president scenes in this film, which ones did you think worked? Did you think any of them didn't work? I mean, Lyndon Johnson or JFK? I thought
John Lennon stuff was not good.
Not good?
The Lennon stuff is the least successful, I think, yeah.
I thought it was clever that they got Dick Cabot and made him up to look like Dick Cabot from that era and then allowed themselves one less thing to have to worry about. That was a clever trick. Because there was heavy use of makeup in this film.
Right, so the Dick Cabot is
with Tom. Yeah, so they get Dick Cabot, can you play yourself and we'll make you up to look like you were from this year? He says yes. They do that, and then you get him being able to deliver the questions and interact with Tom Hanks with only having to put in John Lennon, and so that obviously made life a heck of a lot easier for getting eye lines and everything right.
All the comping seems to be great, and the dropping Tom into all of it seems to be impressive, and removing backgrounds and all the patching they have to do to get him in, replacing a woman shaking hands with Tom shaking hands and all the patching. It does come down to, with John and with a couple of the presents, just down to the lips, and it's just a very subtle thing about the lips that I'm not quite sure why. I wish, you know, what we try and do with this show is rather than just criticize, actually say why, you know, why something doesn't quite work technically. And I just can't put a finger on it. Lips are really hard in that way, I think.
I think if I was in the shot today, I'd probably make a CG mouth and do a CG mouth replacement because I just think they're trying to morph footage. Todd, wouldn't
you? Yeah, it seems like there was a lot, especially with the Lennon stuff, the morphing / frame by frame painting was just the least successful. And I think the Lennon sequence didn't benefit from the editing and the more playful mix of shots with the Kennedy and the Johnson. At least with the Nixon, it was kind of one shot, but the other ones had a little bit more freedom to cut around and do some shot reverse shot stuff, where the Lennon stuff was just kind of a real-time talk show with only cutting between the wide shot and then a close-up of Lennon with that frame-by-frame painting / morphing work, which, you know, there's kind of nowhere to hide. And as with the Nixon footage, there wasn't really anywhere to hide, but for some reason, the timing and everything worked a lot better. I think also the timing of the Lennon and Forrest bits, there's something a little bit off about the scene for me.
I was going to say that, yeah, the editing was wrong, wasn't it? I didn't realize that until you said it. But it was, there were unusual pauses between somebody saying something and Lennon saying something. It was almost like there were two frames you needed to lose. And
they were just trying. I think it was just lingering on John a lot and trying to heighten that emotion of, you know, of his impending, you know, of his loss, and the fact that this is.
And
your last,
I mean, those were also the little fragments of, was that some lyrics from Imagine? Am I wrong about that?
I think that kind of jarred a bit, didn't it?
Yeah. And the Kennedy stuff,
because if they tightened that up and made it more casual, and so you really were having to pay attention, I thought they were telegraphing the Imagine stuff far too much.
I think it was that second piece of magic. You already got the first piece of magic that Tom's in there with Dick and with John Lennon. And I think then to sort of play with the dialogue, I don't know, sometimes it's that second piece of magic that takes you out of a scene.
Todd, did you realize that there were entire sequences that were shot and cut, such as him playing ping pong with George Bush Sr. in China before George Bush Sr. was president, as well as Martin Luther King?
Yeah, the George Bush Sr. stuff, I seem to remember seeing, I think it was on the DVD making of, but they actually got pretty well along in that shot before determining that it was not going to work in the film, not from a visual effects standpoint, for just the flow of the film, cut for time. But was any work actually done on the Martin Luther King bit?
They shot the sequences. For those of you that obviously don't know, the idea in the first one was he was playing ping pong with George Bush in China, who George Bush at that stage was the, I think, American ambassador to China, and he hits him in the groin with the ping pong ball. In the one for, which is more complicated, Martin Luther King, they release vicious attack dogs at the protesters of a Martin Luther King rally, but Forrest has turned up thinking it's just a parade, and isn't it fun that there's a parade? And he knows all the dogs because they're the local police dogs. So when he sees the dogs running viciously at Martin Luther King, he steps in front of them with a stick and calls them by their name, and they all pull up, and then he throws the stick, and they all run away chasing the stick really happily. And then he apologizes to Martin Luther King for getting in the way of his parade. But you have to excuse the dogs. They don't know any better because they're just dogs. And most of that was shot, no, it was all shot, and half comped before they decided that the scene didn't actually further the story, which I've got to say, God, it would be hard to cut those if they were, and they were working. They were, these were not, as you say, shots that weren't working, but they really didn't get us anywhere in the story, did they? I mean, they didn't sort of advance.
Well, did the Lennon stuff really? I mean,
Well, we needed the Lennon stuff for him to be outside the recording to meet. The only thing that the Martin Luther King stuff gave us, which was lost, was that was when Jenny revealed she was going to college. And he said, I wish I could go to college, but I wouldn't be able to. But other than that, that was no real point in the story. So let's discuss one other scene that isn't a TV sequence, which is the Washington reflection pool. I think that worked really, really well at a whole bunch of levels. But obviously done, Jason, in a completely different way than what we do it today.
Well, I mean, I guess you'd still kind of – no, you're right. You'd do it a completely different way. Though basically it is just the classic thing, and we've all sort of been there, of having a crowd of whatever, 200 people, and then you shoot the main footage as they did with Tom and all the veterans coming up to the platform, and literally just the first row of the front part of the reflecting pool was live and in camera. And then I guess obviously mark things off at that lock off point, and then went back and literally did the classic thing of move your 200 people or so around and fill up the frame painstakingly from the old patchwork system. Obviously these days, yes, you'd CGI, you wouldn't even have your 100 people, you'd have none of them and put them all in there, or have literally do 100 people just for placards and just for a bit of reference maybe even, and then just replace them all. What's impressive actually is that when you do look at the plates for that, obviously moving 200 people around takes a while, and it looks like the weather changes about 10 times across all the plates, so literally every single one of those elements. And there's probably to build up that crowd right around the reflecting pool, there's probably 20, 30 sort of passes or so. Every one of them looks like it's in completely different weather. So then to patch that all together with the sunny stuff of the day before and into a moving shot is really, really impressive work. So, I never, ever once do I notice anything wrong there.
And Todd, at the beginning of that shot, it's actually a moving, non-locked-off camera, which I thought was really impressive because that technique would normally require
it. Right. Again, usually in most films you would – cut from a crane shot of Forrest being hurried up to the stage where he doesn't even realize what's going on, and then cut to the lock off over his shoulder or behind him of the thousands of people there. Nope, this is a single camera move, craning up from ground level all the way up through the stage, panning left over Forrest's shoulder over the podium to see this mass of people. And I believe that was shot motion control so that you can get those separate passes. I'm not entirely sure if a lot of the background passes were also motion control, but seriously, it's just like, you look at those shots for the seams, and granted, it's wonderful that it's organic movement of human beings, the randomness of human beings, so you could play a little bit faster and looser with your mat lines, but it just all looks so seamless. And I particularly love the couple subsequent shots over the Abby Hoffman character's shoulder and Forrest's shoulder. Abby Hoffman, Forrest is wearing his hat, right? He's wearing his military outfit. He's got shorn hair, perfect, nice little roto edges. It's not impossible. Abby Hoffman with his frizzy hair flowing around in the wind. And there are mat lines through that hair, and you just can't. I mean, they're split lines. I can't see them. I mean, it's really wonderful work.
It's impressive. They could have pulled back on that and gone really high and kept those foreground characters just on those 200 people they had in foreground, and not had the whole roto pass with people in foreground across not just one plate but across 20 plates. But no, why not? Let's go big. Do the shot you want to do, and make it someone else's problem.
Look, we have two great producers on this show, Matt Graham and Todd Shulton. And Todd found a gem for me in this, which I never, ever knew even existed, which was the missing dialogue of what was said when the plug was pulled. Now, I almost, when I read this, thought, do I want to know? Because in my head, I've made up what he said 100 times. But did you guys see this in the research? The missing lines, you know, when he walks up onto the rally and the microphone's pulled out by whoever that is, a cop or whatever, and apparently Tom Hanks himself said that he said, he's quoted in an interview saying this, that the lines were, sometimes when people go to Vietnam, they come home to their mamas without legs. Sometimes they don't come home at all. That's a bad thing. That's all I have to say about that. And I've often wondered what he would have said in a short amount of time that would have caused the other character to sort of hug him and say, right on, man, that's all you have to say. So sometimes people go to Vietnam, they come home to their mamas without legs. Sometimes they don't come home at all. That's a bad thing.
Great. All the people around him reading far more emotion into the stuff he says than what he intended to say. It's always right on.
Yes. So that, there's a lot of stuff in there, like the Black Panther movie, and I'm sure there are comps out the window there. There's like a million shots that must have had, not a million, but quite a lot of other. But still, the shot count is going to be relatively low on this film compared to a modern effects film. Does anyone know what the shot count would have kind of come in at?
I don't, actually.
That's one thing I'm guessing it's down in the hundreds, and it may be only just so. Because obviously there are obvious effect sequences. But as you say, there are a lot of sky replacements, only one of which bugged me. I must admit, right after the Vietnam napalm sequence that we've discussed at length, there's a shot looking back up as Forrest comes towards somebody, and there's a sky replacement, and you feel that horrible problem where the trees would have gone out to white, and they've tried to put a blue sky in, and so it's really hard to make me believe that the leaves are over blue sky when they seem to be over white, though the kind of matte line says otherwise. I'm picking it because otherwise they were pretty good. I mean, the comps of that reflection of the mountain range in the water when he runs by it, or the comp of even the reflection in the reflection pool for the Washington Monument Vietnam speech, that was all water recomped and sky recomped, and I thought they all worked really
well. It's the beginning of this sort of era, is the beginning of films where we are now starting to see effects that were so good that even today we're not being taken out of the movie to watch them again. And that's obviously, as I say, although it was shot on film and it was edited on film, it is about the first round of all digital films. You don't get taken out quite so much as previous work that's, you know.
It's also where you manage to get very graphic, because that section in Vietnam when the tracer fire is going and the two guys put down their guns and get blown apart, the combination of dummies, actual pyro, and actors on wires being yanked out of shot. There's nothing like an actor being yanked out of shot on a wire to really give you the sense that they've been hit by a high impact velocity bullet.
On that note about the ambush in the Vietnam sequence, you know, curse ILM for doing those tracers so well. Probably the finest Hollywood depiction of tracers ever in a film, because, you know, you look back at Red Tracers, I'm telling you, they are the bane of my existence. they're so difficult to get right, because we know tracers so much from newsreel footage of Vietnam and of World War II, from the perspective of fighter pilots and things like that, that Forrest Gump really nailed the feeling of tracers that almost no subsequent film, even with digital technology, CG tracers or what have you, getting the feel right. And once again, that's shot design and context. The sound work, the fact that we're always from the point of view of the U.S. soldiers, having really feeling the bullets whiz by and having the crazy perspective of a faraway tracer coming right at us and feeling that really happen. I, you know, curse them, you know, God bless them and curse them, because it's
really great direction, I think. And it's a real key Zemeckis thing for me, is that he does these scenes where you entirely see the scene through the lead actor's eyes, you know, like that whole Vietnam scene is all through Forrest's eyes. just like the plane crash in Castaway. You never see any external shots of the plane. It's all him and his experiences from within the aircraft, and it's literally all his experience from you never see that, it's like the faceless enemy. All you see is tracer fire and muzzle flash from the bushes, and it really makes it all the more impactful and dramatic that this faceless thing can just at a drop of a hat just come and bite you out of the bush. And Zemeckis is just so good at that stuff, as I say. The plane crash in Castaway is all the more tense because you just don't know what's going on around you.
Well, speaking of the Zemeckis-Ralston collaboration and something that very few filmmakers can actually do, the whole Kennedy sequence of meeting Forrest Gump, I mean, that was a true tale that wags the dog type story. I mean, they were hunting down footage of Kennedy before the context of the scene had actually been truly established. They didn't really know how that was going to fit into the film until they poured through post-production guys pouring through hours and hours and hours of newsreel footage of Kennedy at the White House, on the Rose Garden, finding all these little clips. And also these archival places not really completely willing to give up the masters of these films quite lightly. So getting videotapes and having Zemeckis review all these things and then say, okay, we have the foresight to look at these 10 shots and we could say, okay, here's an exterior of Kennedy, but he's holding a football. We can roto him out. This will be our establishing shot, and we'll put Forrest in here, and then we'll cut to this, and then we'll cut to that. I mean, they designed a sequence around archival footage and really designed a flow to tell a story. And so very few filmmakers could actually do that. Maybe, like a David Fincher or Cameron or maybe, if Kubrick were still making films, maybe he could. But to have that kind of forward vision is quite extraordinary. And the scene plays so naturally.
Vision he has.
Yeah. I think there's a tremendous collaborative relationship between those two filmmakers that's built on trust. You don't get the impression that it's, this is what I want, go do it, I don't care, just solve it, I don't understand what you're doing. Nor is it, well, we're going to do this thing because it's a really cool shot. Both sides of that fence seem to be meeting, or both sides of that canyon seem to be meeting well in the middle, that they've bridged the divide between the director just demanding what he wants and the visual effects guy just wanting to do the cool shot. The shots seem to have point. They seem, obviously they are cool, but they seem to have a point, as well as being bent to fit what is available, because you can really dip out if you're not flexible to the material. If you can bend a little bit and engineer the footage in correctly, and I really hate it when people don't do that. I really hate it when people like say, "Well, I just want this." It's like, well, you know what? I know you wanted that, but there's this other thing over here. I think this is a better way to go, given what we've got to play with. So, look, I think it's a really good film. There's just no doubt about it. I actually think it stood up really well in the test of time. It's, what, 17 years or something ago that it was released? I'm going to do the math. I think it's
17. You're the maths brain, Mike.
Well, 17 off the top of my head. What did you say it was, like 94? Yeah. So the thing is that ILM, Ken Rolston obviously would go on to do just another huge sets of amazing films. I guess, interestingly, though, we saw Zemeckis take a sort of a tangential line not that long after this and start moving into the image capture realm, which hasn't gone very well at the box office this weekend with Mars Needs Mums. Do you think
tangential is a nice way?
There's been talk of a...
I think.
There is talk of a Gump sequel, Gump & Co., which is even listed on IMDb as in pre-pro. Would we want to see a Gump sequel where he does, in fact, in that treatment, which is only at that stage, it's on it like it's in pre-pro for shooting or anything, has him actually meeting a huge variety of people, including being responsible for the Exxon Valdez disaster and ending up meeting the actor Tom Hanks? Do we think that we'd want to see that film?
Only if it's performance capture.
Only. And only if Tom Hanks does all the roles.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay, and does he have to sing?
Sure, let's have singing.
Great. Okay, good. That sounds like something I really sarcastically don't want to see. Sarcastically don't want to see ever. Yeah, okay. Well, no, but seriously, like, do you think this film... I personally don't know. There's talk of a Who Framed Roger Rabbit sequel as well as a sequel to this.
That would be interesting. That would be interesting to see. That would be interesting to see.
I would prefer to see a Roger Rabbit sequel than I would see a Gump sequel, quite frankly. I don't know. I really want to see a Gump sequel because I think it'd be very hard to not just go over the same ground with new impossible
scenarios. As long as Tom Hanks is the motion capture base for Roger.
You know, the reality is that Roger Rabbit,
it could
there
be
are
bad.
Stories
it could
that
be
are
good,
dying.
It could be bad.
With Roger Rabbit, there are stories that are dying to be told. You know, recapturing the magic that was Forrest Gump with a sequel or a continuation of the story, let's not. Let's not.
I'd like
you know,
to see something fresh from Robert.
When you love a movie so much that you're dying for them never to do a sequel, I mean, that's saying a lot. And like you said, if Robert Zemeckis can get back into the groove of making wonderful live-action films, frankly, let it be anything, but just, go back to making live-action movies that really inspire.
He's such an amazing writer. He's such an amazing writer when you look at, Back to the Futures and obviously with Gump and stuff, there's just been Cast Away and just some fantastic stuff. I'd love to, and creative stuff and new stuff. I'd love to see him, a return to his live action, creative, brand new ideas, brand new stories. So
he's only 59 or 60.
He's
I think.
A young so guy. He's got a lot got of movies ahead of him.
Todd, we're kind of losing you in terms of Skype, so we might wind up at that point. Other than to say, where would people go to find you if they wanted to hunt you down?
You can find me. How about fxrant.blogspot.com? You'll find a lot of inane writings there.
And I can highly recommend it. It's a blog that that I have enjoyed many times. And Jason, for you?
I'm twitter.com/Wingrove or jasonwingrove.com for my website and reel.
So I want to thank you guys for being with us. We have some really great VFX shows coming up. We're probably going to be going for Rango next. We were thinking of going for Battle LA, though I've been told this morning by my team at this end that they, having seen it on the weekend, desperately don't want to hear me talk about it because they don't want to have to relive it. So that's not a good sign.
Well, hey, Rango's a good-looking film.
Rango
that's good enough
is
for
a
two shows.
Film. Rango is a great a great film and very interesting looking. So Jason and I also do a podcast over at the RC on a completely different subject, which is digital cinematography. So thank you so much for being with us, guys, and please check out all our stuff. And if you're going to NAB, keep an eye out for us. We'll be doing stuff on the show floor, especially on the Tuesday down at the post pit. With some friends, including Stu Mashewitz and Tyler Ginter and other people. So thank you so much, Todd, Jace, for being with us. We really appreciate it.
Thanks,
my pleasure.
And we'll catch you guys next time. Thanks so much. Bye.
The world will never seem the same once you've seen it through the eyes of Forrest Gump.
My mom always said life was like a box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to get.
If you have any questions or comments, please email us at vfx@fxguide.com. Copyright 2011 FX Guide, LLC.